Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, voices from a year of war in Sudan.
I think so much has been lost in just this 1 year of conflict.
There's always at the back of my head sounds of war, basically.
It's been heartbreaking.
What have the people endured? And what do they still hope for the future? I'm Natasha Del Toro, and this is The Take. On April 15th, 2023, a year and a day ago, a power struggle between the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and its rival, the RSF, Rapid Support Forces, exploded into full-blown war. The RSF had long been an uneasy partner of the Sudanese Armed Forces, but the collapse of their relationship set the country on a more violent path.
Sudan has plunged into war between the Sudanese army led by General Al-Fatah Burhan and the Rapid Support Forces.
The military leaders signed a deal with political groups, promising to pave the way for fair elections and a return to civilian rule. But disputes about how to integrate the Rapid Support Forces into the army got in the way.
But when Hamid Khalafala thinks about that time just before the fighting started, he remembers a very different Sudan, especially in the capital, Khartoum.
It was just a few days before the end of Ramadan and Eid, and the city was just full of light, full of vibrance and decorations everywhere.
Hamid was born and raised in Sudan. He's now a Sudanese policy analyst. He left Sudan for the UK last year. And he says that last year's Ramadan was unlike anything he's felt before, and perhaps will ever again.
The city, Khartoum, suddenly became full of social and cultural events. I saw so many people that I haven't seen for ages. I was seeing my friends every night because every night there was an event somewhere. And we really enjoyed it. We had a great time. Now, thinking about it, it feels like, you know, Khartoum was bidding farewell to so many things, to us, to that sense of living that we had that Ramadan because of the war.
The fighting engulfed not only Khartoum, but also expanded to all corners of the country. Now for Hamid, returning doesn't feel like a possibility anytime soon.
Although it's a painful reality, I'm also grateful that my last memory and my last experience of Khartoum was not, you know, a city that is being restricted and controlled by a military regime. I'm so grateful that my last memory was something more vibrant and more representative of what Khartoum actually was for many of us.
For those who stay longer or are still there, the memories that they're left with are more harrowing.
My name is Nasreen Al-Amin, and I'm an assistant professor of anthropology and African studies at the University of Toronto. I'm also a member of the Sudan Solidarity Collective based in Canada.
Nasreen's last memories in Sudan are of her evacuation with her three-year-old daughter and elderly parents. They traveled by bus and by ship before reaching Saudi Arabia and then Turkey. This was when we heard from her a year ago.
I'm at the airport in Istanbul right now. I'm feeling mostly exhaustion, but also relief. My parents and I split in Jeddah. They ended up on a different flight to Istanbul and are going to be staying there for a couple of weeks before heading to the States.
She's now back home in Canada, watching the war from a distance.
At times, I wish I had stayed, especially for the elderly women in my family who are less mobile and more vulnerable. And I know it sounds irrational, and it's probably shaped by survivor's guilt, but I worry about those that are unable to leave. Who's going to bring them food and water and medicine? So I worry quite a bit about my family that have had to stay behind in Khartoum, in the Jazeera, in Kordofan, and in other parts of the country. Some twice and now three times displaced and unable to figure out how to get travel documents or basic food items without putting their lives at risk. I also think about the privilege of having been able to get out. And I think about all the parents and caretakers, many of whom are women, who are risking their lives every day to feed their loved ones, how so many of them experience sexual violence, sometimes in their own homes, by RSF soldiers who invade and loot and occupy the intimate spaces of their homes as a result of simply wanting to care for their loved ones. And that's kind of stayed with me. I've known, long known, right, this kind of violence has deeply impacted women in South Sudan, in Darfur, in the Nuba Mountains, and in other marginalized parts of the country for decades. But this war has forced me to think about it differently, beyond the abstract. The shame I felt for not being able to feed my daughter properly, for feeling like I might not be able to protect my nearly 90-year-old father from the barrel of a soldier's gun as he got questioned at checkpoints, these are the moments that have stayed with me.
And Nisreen knows that those moments from her family's journey out of Sudan would likely be even more difficult today.
I often think about how much harder, how much more expensive, how much more dangerous it's gotten for people in my own family and beyond to leave the country. As hard as our journey felt crossing the Red Sea by ship, it is now infinitely harder for people to get to safety, particularly crossing into Chad from various parts of Darfur. Sudan borders 7 countries. The Sudanese diaspora is spread across continents, and yet most of these borders remain very difficult to cross. It was, I think, largely my newly acquired U.S. passport that got us out, and we were incredibly lucky that this privilege was extended to my parents, who don't have a U.S. passport, by Saudi officials who allowed us to keep our family together. If they had refused, we might still all be there.
For those who are still in Sudan, the conflict has displaced more than 8 million people over the past year. Tens of thousands are believed to have been killed, though conditions on the ground have made it difficult to reach an exact death toll. The UN says a humanitarian travesty is playing out in Sudan.
Almost 25 million people, that's around half of Sudan's population, are in need of humanitarian support.
The World Food Program now says what began as a power struggle could become the world's largest hunger crisis.
And yet, between the warring sides, not much has changed the balance of power between the Sudanese armed forces and the RSF.
Neither of them have been really able to gain an upper hand against the other on the battlefield.
That's Matt Nashid. He's an Al Jazeera senior producer who's been reporting on Sudan's war over the past year. He's been covering not just where the fighting has happened, but how brutal the tactics have been. One story that stands out in his memory shows how the violence has increasingly fallen along ethnic lines in the area of West Darfur.
We've seen an entire people, the Masalit, a non-Arab community, that were essentially ethnically cleansed, and most of them now are in Chad at the moment. According to the UN panel of experts, both the RSF and allied Arab militias ended up killing 10 to 15,000 people. That might still be a very conservative estimate. And when the RSF, after essentially beginning its ethnic cleansing campaign in June, finished it off months later when they attacked a displacement camp in West Darfur called Ardamata. And in a matter of a couple of days or a few days, they killed at least 1,300 people, perhaps up to 2,000. We're not going to know. But it was maybe one of the more harrowing massacres that happened in complete silence.
That silence has been hard to bear for the Sudanese people. Many feel the destruction of their country is being forgotten. And within that void, they've organized to fill it how they can. They're led by civil society networks that took shape in the years before this war broke out, during the years of Sudan's pro-democracy revolution.
In 2018, in December, there was a mass pro-democracy protest. And over time, there was these neighborhood local committees, completely civil-led, that coordinated with one another and became, you know, quite sophisticated in the way that they organized protests. And these committees became very much reflective of the needs of people within their community on a grassroots level. And so they were the driving force, the top of then-President Omar al-Bashir.
That happened on April 11th, 2019.
30 years of iron-fisted rule under Omar al-Bashir ended today. He seized power in a military coup 30 years ago, and today he was ousted by one.
So when this war began, members of these resistance committees were already organized. They formed what are known as emergency response rooms.
You know, ferrying vulnerable people out of their neighborhoods where there was heavy clashes, or providing first aid, or things of this sort. And they were incredibly vital at the time because a number of aid agencies had suspended operations when the war erupted in Khartoum. Aid relief and aid operations were incredibly slow to get started in Sudan. And even now, they're really non-existent and in a lot of places through the RSF controls. So neighborhoods and committees were fundamentally reliant on local relief efforts through these emergency response rooms.
But Matt says these lifelines are also being targeted by both sides, the RSF and the army.
Because if you're not for the war or for one of the sides, then you must be against the war.
For Sudanese people caught in the middle, daily survival has become harder. And whatever public services existed before have been almost wiped out. Infrastructure that's crucial for survival has been hit, including transportation and medical care.
The UN says 70% of hospitals around the country aren't functioning. In Khartoum, only a handful remain open.
Network towers, power lines, and other infrastructure have been damaged in a war that has raged now for a year.
No phone signals, no internet, and no telecommunications at all.
And Sudan has been in a total internet blackout since early February. Throughout the conflict, the RSF and the army have been accused of blocking internet access in areas controlled by the opposing side. That's made it difficult to do things like coordinate aid and mobile banking, as well as more basic things like staying in touch with people. Back in May last year, we spoke with Dr. Ahmed Omar, an emergency medicine specialist in Khartoum. Even back then, the situation was dire as the RSF seized hospitals to use as their own bases.
They come attack the hospital, they attack the doctors over there, the patients, and they kick everyone out.
Many doctors have left the country for safety, but Dr. Omar said at the time that he was determined to stay.
I don't know, there is no enough time nowadays for us to think. Maybe if I have some time, maybe I would think to evacuate or escape, but I don't think I'll do that.
We've been unable to reach Dr. Omar since then. His fate is so far unknown. After the break, what the fight for Sudan's future looks like now.
Get your news in less than 3 minutes, three times per day, with the Al Jazeera News Updates. Just ask your home device to play the news by Al Jazeera or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
As more Sudanese people flee the war, the diaspora has grown. Khalud Hare is part of the movement trying to bring global attention to Sudan's suffering.
I'm the founding director of Confluence Advisory, a think and do tank formerly based in Khartoum.
Khalud was also forced to leave Khartoum last year for the United Kingdom. Since then, she says it's brought some relief to speak out and bring attention to her country. But it's also highlighted the failures of the international community in responding to Sudan's needs.
You know, the war in Sudan is something that has received very little media and policy attention, and the two often go hand in hand. But that is a choice. It is not as if the people of Sudan have not been highlighting what they have been going through. It is not as if humanitarian aid agencies have not been ringing the alarm about the famine that is already upon Sudan, about the humanitarian disaster that is already upon Sudan. And these are statistics, these are reports, these are stories that have been around for almost a year. So it's not a question of the world not seeing and not remembering. It is an active choice by many people around the world, including policymakers, not to see and not to remember what is going on in Sudan.
This lack of action has made Khulod skeptical of any claims that a ceasefire among the warring sides might be coming soon.
I think that the prospects for ceasefire today are as slim as they were at around the six-month mark. The UN had planned for a Ramadan ceasefire to be in place, and even though the resolution miraculously passed at the UN Security Council in New York, there has been no movement at all from any of the belligerent sides to actually adhere to this UN resolution calling for a ceasefire because of the holy month of Ramadan and then the Eid festivities. If anything, we're expecting that the military campaigns will not cease in the near future. The two sides still believe that prosecuting this war militarily still remains an enticing prospect for them over the prospect of a mediated settlement. That doesn't mean that a mediated settlement or a ceasefire is not possible in the future. All of Sudan's wars have ended in a mediated settlement. None have been settled militarily. But it just means that the conditions right now are not ripe for that.
But even without those conditions for a ceasefire, Khulod refuses to give up on the Sudanese people.
You know, history tells us that this war may last 20 years, but if this war even lasts a fraction of that, 5 years or 10 years, so much more may be lost, which means that pockets of hope are very difficult to come by. Having said that, we are seeing that despite all the grim realities of this conflict, despite where this conflict may take us, we're seeing ordinary people within communities come together to prepare and deliver aid to each other, protecting each other through the difficult times and incursions by soldiers. But really, I think the shining spark is that, you know, a few days ago, we celebrated the anniversary of the April 6th uprising of 1985 and the anniversary during the 2019 revolution, when many people flooded into the capital city demanding the fall of the Bashir regime.
Officials in Sudan say that President Omar al-Bashir has been removed from power. The country's defense minister made the announcement following weeks of protests.
And although there was jubilation on the streets that al-Bashir had gone, protesters are saying they will not be happy until power has been transferred to civilians.
And it was a timely reminder, really, to remember that there's a greater thing here that we're all fighting for, and that those pro-revolution sentiments and those fighting for a democratic Sudan still remain and will continue to remain. So there is still hope there that once the dust has settled, there will still be these embers of revolution that will allow some form of civilian democracy to burn in Sudan in the future.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by Miranda Lin with Amy Walters, Ashish Malhotra, Chloe K. Lee, David Enders, Veronica Campana, Khaled Sultan, Nagin Oliai, Suri El Khalili, Sonia Bagat, Zainab Badr, and me, Natasha Del Toro, in for Malika Bilal. Our sound designer is Alex Roldan. Alexander Locke is The Take's executive producer. And Ney Alvarez is Al Jazeera's head of audio. We'll be back tomorrow.